On this episode of Interview in Indies, we talk to Danny from Dream Tech Studios and talk about all the different struggles that a small indie team may face, whether it be from marketing a game or making a game as a whole. If you want to support the show and get the episodes a few days early, you can subscribe to us on Patreon. And of course, enjoy the show. Hello, welcome to Interview in Indies Episode 5. I'm the host, Burr, and today I'm joined by Big Danny, or Danny Makes Games, who works with Dream Tech Studios, who have made the game Lifeslide, and they're somewhat working on Overrider. Danny, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Hello, I'm Danny. I make games for about 7 years now. And yeah, I'm here to share my experience with the industry and everything in between.
I mean, you have a lot more experience than some other people that have been on here, but everyone seems to be averaging 5 to 10 years. So I guess we can ask, how did you get into game development and this industry? What inspired you? What brought you in here?
All right. So we're going right into the long stories first, huh?
Okay. Yeah, right into the long stories. We got time.
All right. So the story begins in the year 2012, when I was fresh out of high school and I didn't think what to do with my life. I didn't think about this stuff and I didn't know what to do. So I was already a lot of into computers and stuff. So computer science was an easy solution. So I got into that. And by the time I was done, I kind of didn't want to do it anymore. So right after I graduated my university, I reached out to a friend who had a studio, and it is Dream Tech. The CEO is a very close friend of mine, so I reached out and I said, "Hey, I want to get into game dev. I think I'm going back to it because I was doing some stuff early on in high school years." But he said, "Sure thing. Let me send you some information over. Let me bring you up to speed of what they are doing." And so I was self-teaching myself level design for about a year and a half when the opportunity came with Lifeslide. And my friend was like, "Why don't you come on board and like part-time and just start working on some stuff, start getting stuff in the works." So that being said, I started there 2017, I think it was. And I do have some footage to show you of Lifeslide before it was Lifeslide, like before it had a name. Yeah, I did. we were doing some really, really, really cringy vlogs.
Some cringy vlogs. Let's hear these.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna copy a link and I'm gonna send it over. It's unlisted. Nobody else can see this. But us. This and this is our first vlogs.
Making music for a procedurally generated game.
Yes. It is. Fair warning. It is cringy. It is very cringy. And that's how I started in the game dev industry. It was just an opportunity that a friend gave me.
Music
with no strings attached, and then just been working with him ever since.
All right, I'm gonna open up this first link. People listening on Patreon will not be able to hear it. That's a gunfire. Oh my goodness, you're gonna get me thrown off the air. All right, let's see.
Oh, that's a gunfire sound effect.
Making music for a procedurally generated game. We'll listen to the first 30 seconds or so.
It was created by humanity as a form of art. Sound poems pouring into our hearts, communicating emotions better than any words ever could.
Okay.
Music flies across space aboard the Voyager, and it's widely used in games.
You started off very serious with it, with the space thing,
and then,
and then he just pops up. Okay. The game dev vlog. Game dev occasionally.
Yeah, that was our thing back then.
Being a little cringy. You just started with Dream Tech at this time? Were you starred in? Were you in this first devlog?
I am minute and 30 seconds. Minute and 20 seconds. Minute and 20 seconds.
Oh, I found you.
Music for a game. The way we do it is we go back to the game design document and try to immerse in the atmosphere of a level. Then we start searching for reference, keeping in mind all symbols,
oh, emotions, my goodness, and illusions. You look so different there.
I had a bigger beard for sure.
You did have a bigger beard. No hat.
No hat, yeah.
So when that happened 7 years ago, you were still self-teaching yourself. How much experience did you feel like you had with the self-teaching? Did you feel like you were a little behind compared to everybody else?
I was feeling a lot behind. I was feeling absolutely new to the thing. And I was reading articles, I was watching YouTube videos, I was doing everything that I could, like with the information available, but I still didn't feel like I was good enough. Of course, imposter syndrome, it is a thing. So when I started back in that little office, that was a garage that was turned into an office, and it belonged to that guy, that CEO's parents. So that's where we started.
Where the office was?
Yeah, that was where the office was. And it was a small room, not bigger than a single bedroom. Like, I don't know, 11 square meters, something like that. Just really small. It had space for 4 people in total, no more than that. And we were 4 people, and just everything was neck to neck, basically. And then something curious happens. I'm showing you these vlogs because how LifeSlide started was a very peculiar situation. We were like 2017, 2018. We were doing this. I was doing this part-time for 2 years now. So 2019 was coming. And no, 2019 already came. So I was doing this for about 2 years. Part-timey, and I was really fed up with my job, and I was looking for ways around it. And then opportunity came when we didn't expect it. Those vlogs, those cringy-ass vlogs.
Those cringy vlogs.
Those helped us. Like, a publisher saw them, right?
Yeah.
And the studio had already had a... maybe I can send you a... The first LifeSlide trailer, and they saw that, and they saw the cringy vlogs, and they saw that we did have some assets on the asset store that we've developed. And they decided that we're going to be perfect for Apple Arcade.
Oh, Apple Arcade. So did they help you get LifeSlide on? I didn't even know it was on Apple Arcade. I just thought it was on Steam and Switch.
Yeah, we don't talk about it that much because we are no longer on Apple Arcade, so like we just
it was only there for a short amount of time.
Well, short amount of time would about 2 years.
Oh, 2 years is
not that short amount of a time. But still, that publisher that published the game on the Apple Arcade store just give us a really solid opportunity. And like the phone call came, I think it was a Thursday, about lunchtime. And my friend just gave me a call and say, go fucking quit your job.
Oh, and so they were providing big funding. I was going to ask, you said you were fed up with your job. I want to make sure you were fed up with another job and not the game development job.
Yeah. Another job. I was working in a call center back then.
Not everyone.
So I was looking away around. Yeah. And like the phone call came, go quit your job. And I did. And it started working out. That was about 2.5, let's say 2.5 years in. That's when I started to get my hands really dirty, because I was doing this for not just part-time, like 3 to 4 hours, but actually 8, 12, 16 hours a day. So now I could get more information in. I could try more stuff. I had an actual machine that I could work on, not a shitty old laptop that I had. And I could try to do stuff, try to develop a pipeline, see where things could be changed, see how the gears are turning in a video game. Those things are important when you start learning about game development, just what things are and how do they influence each other, like the programming side of it, the art side of it, how do they relate, how the designer creates a level group, how does he define a level. That's all questions that every designer goes through and figures out on his own, basically, most of the time. Because it is very personal and very tied to the game. So they saw that trailer, and like you can create an image of how Life's Light looks today and how it looked
back then,
5 years ago. Yeah, 5 years ago. And there's another one that's even further back.
That's, I'm gonna click that first trailer.
Yeah, those are
the initial trailers. Oh my god, yes. The game looks totally different. Not like totally, but like you polish the game up a lot more. And just in case someone doesn't know what Life Slide is, why don't you explain what Life Slide is, just in case someone listening doesn't know it?
Life Slide is a paper airplane adventure. It is a metaphorical journey through life where you fly gather materials, upgrade yourself, and try to go through a series of stages that are procedurally generated. That's basically it. I call it the Souls-like of paper airplanes, or the Dark Souls of paper airplanes, because this is something that I will touch on later on, but Life's Light has a big problem in it, baked from the start. And that problem is a fight between how it looks like and how it plays. And the player expectation on one end and what they actually get and how do they feel about the game later on as they progress through the game. That is the biggest flaw of Life's Light, in my opinion. How it looks versus how it plays. It looks cozy. It looks cute. It looks very relaxing.
Oh, yes, it does.
But in actuality, it is very hard, it is very challenging, and it has a very unique set of movement mechanics, as we like to describe ourselves, the studio with the unique mechanics, movement mechanics. We're obsessed with movement, we're obsessed with speed. So yeah, that's how I started with Life's Light. I was in charge of making all the levels, remaking the existing levels and adding a suitable pipeline and suitable level design approach for everything to be consistent. And so I started just to work on it day after day. And we published Life's Light on Steam 2021, August, I think it was, right after the last E3.
Oh, yeah, the last E3. Now, why didn't you guys go for Xbox or PlayStation with Life's Light? Because you went with Switch, which I think is a good choice. It's a very, like you said, it looks like a cozy game, but it isn't. Why not Xbox or PlayStation?
Well, that is an interesting question, because in our minds back then, we didn't realize at first that big flaw of the game. I don't think any one of us realized that the game had such a juxtaposition between the feel and the look of it. And so we said, it looks low poly. It is very controller friendly, almost 100% recommended controller play. So Switch is the natural platform for it. And that's how we kind of made a decision. We didn't think about like the player base back then that much. And that is a mistake on our part. But that's how the decision was made. Like, it looks okay. It looks perfect for Switch. So let's go for Switch.
Now, you do think that was a mistake, not going to other consoles?
Probably. I think in retrospective, yeah, probably it was a mistake not going for Xbox PlayStation. There were other issues with Xbox and PlayStation, of course. SDKs had to be ordered. They had to be ordered for Switch as well, but the process is a bit longer on PlayStation. I'm not sure about Xbox. I think it's a bit about the same as PlayStation, but Nintendo Switch ordering process is kind of easy. So you can get an SDK really fast, like in 3 weeks, I think. So, yeah, I think in retrospective, I would have gone for Switch, for PlayStation and Xbox rather than Switch.
Now, I am not a developer. We all know that. I don't have the talent. I've heard rumors. I don't know if these are true. For updating a game on consoles like this, is it a lot harder of a process to deliver a patch onto Switch or maybe even Xbox and PlayStation compared to Steam?
Yeah, it is. It is harder because every platform has its own requirements. That's the main issue that developers face. For example, Nintendo Switch, in certain regions, you can push an update in this period of time, but in other regions, it has to be this period of time. And for some regions, it's all of the periods, but some have restrictions, some don't. The same with the store page. You can push updates to it only in certain time periods. I haven't published a game on PlayStation, so I'm not 100% sure, but I have heard from friends that I have that kind of a similar process. A lot of regions, a lot of planning has to be done. But on Steam, it's just upload a patch, boot it, and set a release date, and just be done with it. It's a lot easier.
I see. That's probably why so many people just settle to go on Steam, because they might not have the money to and the resources to get out to PlayStation and Xbox. But what about something like Game Pass? Let's say you did upload to PlayStation, Xbox, everywhere with LifeSlide. Would you have gone with Game Pass if that was an option, or is that something like a publisher deals with?
9 times out of 10, that's what a publisher deals with. 9 times out of 10. If you were to go as a developer and reach out to Xbox, because Game Pass as of now is still exclusive platform, right? So you have to be screened, you have to provide certain documents, and those kind of things take time and take resources out of the studio. So 9 times out of 10, a publisher deals with it, and it's the best way to go about it.
Okay. Now, the publisher that did the Apple Arcade stuff, were they the publisher on Steam as well?
No, they were just...
They were just Apple Arcade?
Apple Arcade. Only Apple Arcade. And the game back then was, of course, mobile. And people played it on their phones. And we had to go through a lot of learning experiences, because LifeSlide started as a mobile project. And then we transitioned to a desktop project. And we started to target more of the desktop audience. That's why the mechanics were done in that particular way, because we were looking at the game and like, oh yeah, this would be fun if it was a bit harder and a bit more challenging, and it had a bit more room to grow, and it had a bit more complexity. And so we did that. And then and then the deal with Apple Arcade came, and it was like, oh well, let's go back to mobile. and what happened was that it actually just, the Apple Arcade reviews at first were like from 5-star rating, we were barely covering 2 stars. Barely. So it wasn't very good game in the start when we launched an Apple Arcade. We did manage to get it up to almost 5 stars with a lot of work and a lot of updates. And Apple devices, iOS devices, are really picky with their stuff. And Apple is really picky with its processes and how they do things. So we had struggled with that. And but the deal was very good, and we did it did allow us to get an actual office, hire people, buy more tech, buy computers, screens, office space, buy everything that we need to be able to develop games.
So how many people were working with it before? I think you said four. How many people did you hire for the process once this deal went through?
Well, at first we were four people. And then right before the deal came through, I think there were three of us left. So basically we started with three. And at the end of the hiring process, about 12. Yeah.
12 people. Oh my goodness.
12 people. Yeah, it was a transition. It was really transitional period. Like, scaling from 3 to 12 people is no easy feat. It was very challenging design-wise. It was very challenging management-wise, because like, managing people is a whole different beast from just making a game at home, making a game in a garage. That's a whole different story.
Now, you went from mobile to like desktop back to mobile, and this was still your first major project. Yep. You feel like it was, what was like the biggest challenge while trying to develop a game for mobile and then going to desktop? Was there a lot of variables for someone like you who didn't have as much experience as others?
Absolutely, yeah. It had a lot of variables, and I had to learn a lot about player behavior and player engagement with a game, and why do they do things in a game specifically, how they look at like, for example, the choices that we offered, how to make that feel good to play and at the same time be easier to develop, because like, we were scrambling. We were 12 people, but we're still pushing content as crazy. And it was a challenge for mainly just pushing the content through. And I had to be a lot on my tiptoes and pivoting around ideas and changing whatever. I had to learn a lot of humility, of course, because I've heard this phrase somewhere, nothing humbles you more than looking at a player stumble around your level. And like, when you see a person not getting the level and not getting like the choices that they need to make, and just see them fumble their way through the game, you really have to take a step back and just say, okay, I've done messed up. Let's try to fix it. Let's scale back, see what we can do better. Let's go that approach. Let's go this other approach there.
There's a lot of stuff that goes into it. Now, LifeSlide, like you said, it got released 2021. And yeah, you guys did have a second project over at DreamTech, which there's a lot to unwrap with this project. But we can just start right away with it, with Overrider. Talk about that game. Sell it to us a little bit. Explain, I guess, what started with Overrider. How did you get inspiration for this game?
Okay. So I'm going to start by quickly covering how we looked at LifeSlide and what inspirations we got it from, because I think it's relevant. Okay. So we are, me, Mitko, the CEO, are mountain bike riders. We love mountain bikes. We love extreme sports. Well, we do all kinds of different stuff. And the main inspiration for LifeSlide was paragliding, actually. And I know it gets a lot of comparisons with Flower and like a bunch of cozy games, but the main inspiration was paragliding. And if you've seen paragliding, it's very, very reminiscent of the feel that you get from LifeSlide. It's flying close to stuff and watching your momentum, and one wrong move and you're out. So I've never done paragliding myself, just to be clear, but I really loved a lot of the videos and I love the feel that they gave, and I tried to replicate that in a game. So we kind of did the same for Overrider. It is a roguelike action adventure on a hoverboard, where speed is your most dangerous weapon. That's the gist of it, and that's what we're trying to sell. Speed is the danger. Speed is your main weapon. You deal damage as you gather speed. The more speed you have, the more damage you're gonna deal. And the main challenge of the game is to gather enough speed just before hitting an enemy. Now, the main inspirations were Risk of Rain, because just before we started with Overrider, we were kind of looking around the market and seeing what was popping and what kind of games were being played. And of course, it was the start of the roguelike craze. Like Hades like had a year from release, and a lot of games like Hades were popping. And we're like, okay, let's try Hades. Let's see what it's about. So we tried Hades. And then we saw Risk of Rain, and we're like, oh, that looks interesting. Let's try Risk of Rain. So we tried Risk of Rain 2. And I kind of fell in love with it the moment I started playing. And one thing that you need to know for me is that when I fall in love with a game, I play the bejesus out of it. I crank in hours after hours after hours, and I try to beat it multiple times, try to compete with it, see where I can get myself. That's why I have ungodly amount of hours in Rocket League and competitive games, some RTS games, Apex Legends. Those kind of competitive games are my jam. And when I started to play Risk of Rain, I kind of got the same itch. So I managed to beat it on the hardest difficulty, then climb the Eclipse game mode. And I'm like, yeah, I really like this genre. I really like roguelikes. From the limited experience that I have with roguelikes. And I was like, I want to do this in an open world environment. And that's how Overrider started. But on the other end of the line, we had Mitko, who is a speed junkie that really likes going fast in games. And so he kind of like took inspiration from snowboarding and mountain biking, and came up with the hoverboard idea and said, hey, why don't we make it a hoverboard? That way it's unique, and we can take inspiration from games like Steep and other like SSX, Tricky, and all those retro styles, retro games. And yeah, that's how it started. And I was just, yeah, let's put a hoverboard in a roguelike environment. That would be neat. That's something that I would be interested in when I look in a game. And let's make it difficult, and let's make it a roguelike. And yeah, that's how we started to like develop the whole idea. From there, I started to work on the level design approach. And then I came up with the mods and the upgrades idea, and how do you get them and what do they do, and those kinds of things. I started writing stuff down, which I'm not very good at still, but
yeah, you got to learn somehow. Practice makes perfect, especially in a video game.
Absolutely. Practice makes perfect. Documents are really important for game development, and a lot of people don't like them, me included, but you have to write stuff down.
Yeah, now, with Overrider, you, just like in Lifeslide, you had a lot of devlogs as well. And a few of the devlogs, I was watching the process since day one. I've known you for a few years now. A few of those devlogs really popped off, you could say. A couple of them have a few hundred thousand views on YouTube. Do you feel like that helped a lot with the marketing for the game? Or did you?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you feel you didn't... what's the word? Like, you didn't... Oh, God, I'm blanking on the word. You didn't, like... It helped with the marketing, basically.
It did, in some ways. Looking at our channel, like, yeah, a couple of those devlogs have about... Like, one of them has 380,000, and another was 125,000. But after that, it kind of tapered off around 5K to 8K views. But still, that's not nearly good enough numbers for a marketing campaign. And that's just us. And we're not reaching a lot of new people that way. And I think the marketing part and, again, the visual of the game compared to what it is still a problem with our studio. Like, apparently we don't know how to make the visual match the feel of the game. And that's kind of where we at right now. But what I would say is marketing is a very difficult task. And it's a very particular task that needs to be handled by a person or a team of people that really know what they're doing. And fumbling around and trying different things rapidly without knowing what you need to do is very damaging to your strategy. And once you lose the momentum,
it's gone.
You've lost the momentum. It's gone. It's out.
Yeah, I can relate to that with, you know, it's the same with content creation. You get like a little boom, you got to capitalize on it. If you don't, you're back to square one. So
absolutely.
Do you feel the marketing was the biggest fumble with Overrider? Because you had a Kickstarter, you had a Twitter account for DreamTech, but did like Overrider have its own Twitter account? What do you feel like you and the team could have done better on marketing? You could just say hire professionals, but like, maybe you have a limited budget. What do you think you guys could have done better?
Well, it is about time restrictions, right? You have to keep making the game and at the same time market it, but the marketing push should be constant. And we couldn't provide that constant marketing push. We couldn't provide that constant posting, that content that needs to go out, and that network that needs to get built between usually a marketing agency and its content creators, because that's how most of the game dev world works. Most content creators don't work directly with developers. They either work with a marketing agency or with a publisher. That's how it is. And unfortunately, if you cannot do the marketing and you don't have the network for that reason, for whatever reason, actually, it's not just time restrictions. Maybe you're just more introverted person. That's okay. Just need a publisher for that or need a marketing agency. Basically someone professional that would hire marketing and be able to provide that push, because I cannot like work on a game for 9, 10, 12 hours a day and then spend more on the marketing. I will burn out in a week.
Yeah, I think most normal people would, because we all know social media is exhausting. Some people may think, oh, you just have to tweet something. But there's so much more behind marketing with making hype videos, all the clean edits, the correct tweets, knowing when to tweet. And that's just so much work on top of what you already have to do.
Yes. And marketing is the biggest fumble. And what we could have done better is either take away from the team and just have a dedicated marketing person that would do pushes, that would do everything, but that's hard to do because marketing is a separate job. Basically, if I give a program or a marketing title and he'll fumble it as well, it doesn't matter that he's going to be dedicated for that task. Like, if you don't know what you're doing, it doesn't matter if you're doing it 10 hours a day. At first, you're going to be a noob, essentially. So yeah, I think marketing-wise, we should have started looking at publishing deal maybe from the start. Right from the start, because we were just kind of be done with publishers, because with LiveSlide, we had a couple of negative experiences with publishers. One of them decided to not ask permission and break the DRM of Steam and upload it to GOG without our permission. And that was a no-no, that you can't do that with a game. And we were just kind of fed up with publishers and saying, no, we don't want a publisher. We're just going to do it ourselves. Well, we did it ourselves and we failed miserably.
You didn't fail miserably. Well, there was definitely some ups and downs. Now, for people that may not understand the lingo. What is a DRM in the Steam world for that? Is that kind of like an NDA type thing for uploading games?
No, the DRM is a system for preventing piracy. So you can't just take the game, zip it from Steam, and just upload it somewhere. It wouldn't work. And that's the DRM. That's a system that you put on top of the game that prevents it from being opened outside of that platform that you have the DRM for. So, for example, a DRM, a GOG have their own DRM. PlayStation have their own DRM. Xbox have their own. Epic Games have their own. Like, every platform essentially has their own DRM. That's what it basically is in a lot of layman's terms, because it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, just protection piracy.
Yeah, protection piracy. That's the gist of it.
That's a good thing to have, because nobody... If I see people pirating indie games, I'll be questioning a lot of things. Now, you guys say you failed miserably. Some people will say you didn't because, you know, 300,000 views. That's incredible on YouTube, they would say, which is still a good amount. But you did launch a Kickstarter, which I did want to contribute to, but I sadly also do not have a lot of money. I wish I could just publish a million indie games, but yeah. What would you say to some smaller indie teams out there that maybe don't have a publisher, but they're thinking they're kind of going down the same route as you, and like they're about to upload a Kickstarter, and what would you say to like maybe prioritize with the Kickstarter to help it gain momentum?
And my advice would be prepared for the worst. And if you can, quick tip, don't think about the goal of the Kickstarter as a goal that you need to develop the game. Think about it as a marketing tool. Don't think about it as a fundraising tool, because game development is expensive. Whether we like it or not, it is more expensive than a lot of things to develop in terms of software. So don't try to reach crazy amounts of money. And for a pro tip, I would say try to have the money before you start the campaign. So even if you do not raise anything from it, you just fund it and not have that failed Kickstarter as a bad spot on your record, as a red spot. That would be my goal. Don't use it for fundraising, use it for marketing. That's what it's good at. And because game development is expensive, more often than not, people will not raise the money that they're needing for development. They'll raise a insignificant amount of money for it. I can go into more details if you want about how much does it cost to run a studio, because I have some information about that as well.
If you are open to sharing it, it would be enlightening for people that aren't in the industry to know how expensive it is, even if it's just a small studio making some smaller games.
Absolutely. A lot of it is dependable on what you're doing exactly. But the gist of it is you have some fees that you cannot avoid, from the government to the running the company, accounting and whatnot. A lot of the studios like run on the same kind of structure, which is 4 to 5 to 6 developers. And in developers, I do include artists, designers, and programmers. A lot of the other things are outsourced, like animations, sound effects, music. A lot of it is outsourced nowadays. So a price of about 30,000 for a team of 6 people, considering all the necessary fees. Let's say you don't have an office, but for a creative work, you should have an office. And you should be working semi-locally and just gather people in an office, because creative work really does benefit from an office environment, And I say office, what I mean, a friendly environment that you can collaborate with really easily. And yeah, 30,000 a monthly burn rate for a studio. Let's multiply that by a 2-year development cycle. So times 24.
So it's $30,000 a month.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. That is what, $640,000 a year or something? $680,000 a year? 2 years?
So 360 for a year. So times two, it's
$720,000. And that's just a small team for 2 years.
For 2 years. Yeah. The time really does play a big role in it. And, you know, I'm including a lot of the things that, like, you don't know, like, ZBrush is a paid software. You have to pay for it. Unity have a seat type of deal where they charge you by how many people are in the team. You can kind of get away with some ghost people, but not a lot. You should pay for that. You should have a licensed software. That money goes also for, let's say you don't have an office, let's just say, but if you're developing a multiplayer game, server maintenance, server, any type of infrastructure that you need for the team, file sharing. A lot of the things for game dev, especially the art things, are kind of heavy in size. So you need kind of a better solution than Google Drive.
Oh, yeah. Sending
over. Yeah, those things would catch up. Like even repositories in GitHub, they have a limit. So you have to work around it. You have to purchase extra storage for that as well. Maybe if your game gets too big, you have to shill for it. So yeah, game development is not cheap in any way, shape, or form. And like, imagine if we said the Kickstarter go for like 700,000.
Yeah, if anybody saw a Kickstarter for that much for any indie game, they would think they're crazy. But that's just the sad reality, that it's just that expensive. Because like you said, there's so many things that just add up one after another.
Yep. And if you have an office,
that's even more expensive.
Like, that's even more expensive. So running an indie team is no joke. And that's why a lot of people don't have an office. They work remotely. That's like a lot of people don't have big teams. They like 3 developers, like an artist, a developer, and a designer. And that's kind of it. And that's all well and good until your games get bigger and you're expected to launch in 6 months and you don't have half the features. That gets a big red flag.
Now, with the time window, I imagine having that window of time to upload a game in this time frame, that's usually publishers, right, that are pressuring you to get it out by then because, you know, they're invested in it and they want their money.
Yep. Most of them. But a lot of the times, if you leave developers unchecked, where you don't have a person that like oversees deadlines and whatnot, in my experience, more often than not, they're going to go over the deadline. And by they, I mean us, because I do it as well. Every developer is guilty of that. But yeah, the publisher is the main drive for getting a product out of there. And there's a dedicated position for it, like a project manager or a producer on a higher level. But like you can tell, in a 3-person indie team, everyone's a project manager and everyone needs to sort their tasks out and be working in a consistent way so that he doesn't burden other people, because there's so few of them. You cannot like bother the programmer for a feature that would save you any amount of time, because he's busy doing the main features, for example, and like that needs to be considered. And like the project could really, really quickly run out of scope really easily.
there's so many things. Now, I had one more quick question about the pricing again for games.
Sure.
Your studio that you work with is in Bulgaria, which yep. is in Europe, for people that don't know. I don't know what currency you use in Bulgaria, but for the $700,000, was that the Bulgarian currency, or are we talking the standard US dollars?
We've converted it to standard US dollars.
Oh my goodness. I was just thinking maybe it could be Bulgarian currency, but
no, it is that's the price for running a studio for 2 years, right? And that includes everything. And you can cut corners from here and there. That number can get lower and in a significant amount if you do the right things. That number also includes every expense, like out of the studio. For example, if you want to give Christmas bonuses, if you want to have benefits, if you want to have outsource the music, like the music has to be paid and that kind of stuff. That's not strictly about running the
It's everything. The
specific project, it's everything, right? That's the number that we've come up with. And that's with good salaries. Salaries that are above the livable of our country here. So that's not the minimum amount, and that's not the maximum amount. That's just a thing that's realistic for us, given our experience. It may be limited experience, like we've already we've been running the studio for 7 to 8 years as a studio with expenses and income. But yeah, somewhat gives an idea of how expensive game development is in reality, because a lot of people assume like, oh yeah, just take the salaries, five developers and give them a 2K salary and just be good with it. And it's not that simple. Yeah. It's just not that simple.
Now, you mentioned some outsourcing work. And I saw on the DreamTech website that you guys do some outsourcing work. Any outsourcing work you can share that you guys have done yourself on other games, or?
I don't think I can share any because I think we're still under NDA.
Oh, but you have some projects in there. Just can't share.
We have some projects. We've outsourced some projects for clients here and there. It's nothing major. It's nothing that's really successful or anything. It's just some projects. It's a way to get some more income in the studio.
Oh yeah, 100%. Gotta do that. Now we can go back to Overrider a little bit. I remember back in, I think it was just a month ago, because you're in my Twitch chat a good amount. You're always telling me the updates, and there's always good news, and then it's really bad news. Like Overrider, we might get a publisher. Oh, we're closing everything down. What was the process for you like when you were pitching to a publisher? What do you wish you prepared a little bit more when pitching to people? And how was the process of getting, I guess, an interview with a publisher?
Well, that department here is very hard to explain. The reason that it's hard to explain is because publishers are looking for a lot of things that most developers cannot provide. And that goes for any like desktop project, and it's a whole different beast for mobile project. Because publishers are looking for, because they're strictly wanting to make money. And how do they make the money doesn't really necessarily matter, because they're looking for, do you feel a niche in the market? How possible it is for you to make us money, and that kind of thing. While we're pitching an idea for a game with cool mechanics, and we're talking about the art style, we're talking about the mechanics, we're talking about the progression, and like publishers don't really care necessarily about those features. They do care about, we have a neat monetization system, we have a battle pass, we have it's going to be a premium game. It fills a niche between two genres that are really popular, and I think we're going to sell in that department. And they run their twos, and they see, okay, yeah, those guys might have a shot to make us some money, Let's try to bring it forward, and so on. For us, it's really, really difficult to get a publisher talking to us. I am still not sure why exactly, to be perfectly fair. I don't know why. I don't know if we're not good enough to look at. I don't know if our voice is annoying. No idea why, but we are struggling to get a publisher to talk to us. And one part of it is I'm sure they get swamped with developers. Absolutely swamped with the email. No possibility for one single email to get through. Hundreds and hundreds of unread emails are present in their inbox. I'm sure of that. That is one reason for sure. But another reason, I don't know. I really can't tell. That's a question that I have as well.
But you did, I think it was at GDC, or not GDC, what was it?
Gamescom.
Yeah, it was Gamescom. Did you, I think you said you had a couple meetings with them, which I imagine is easier to get their attention in person compared to, like you said, the 100 unread emails. Did you have a couple meetings, or did those flop too?
Well, two of them flopped, and we had a meeting with a publisher that went super quick, super breezy. They were like, yeah, send us an email, basically not shutting us down, but
that's kind of
it's it's a nice letdown. But yeah, it's really hard to get a hold of a publisher.
It's crazy really that you say that, because I've had a couple guests on here where publishers end up reaching out to them, where it's just, they just get lucky, and obviously there's a lot of big name publishers out there, you know, the Raw Furies, the Devolver Digitals. I imagine those level of publishers aren't reaching out to people, and they're kind of just taking games. They are. It's just hard. It's just super rare to see.
It is rare to see, and it's the survivalist bias, where we look at the successes of the indie game sphere, and we're looking, those things happen, and they do. They're just, you don't see like the 3 million developers in the back that have tried and failed.
Yeah.
And it's really like, I don't want to say one in a million, but I'm going to say it. But it is one in a million to get a good deal with a publisher. And again, they're trying to make money, and they're free to choose who to work with. So no one owes you anything for like having a good game, even if it is the perfect game. Like, you don't get a chance if you don't provide what they're looking for. But pitch deck is something that all developers should have for their games. Definitely pitch deck. Try to get in contact with a publisher. Try to get some contacts, like solid networking going. That's something that a lot of my developer friends are lacking. A lot of no networking, very introverted people. I get it, but you have to have the connections.
Yeah, it's the same with content creation. If you know people, they know people, you connect with people, and it's just an endless line of networking. You know someone, now you know they know someone, you know the person they know, and then the person that they know knows someone, and now you know two people. And
absolutely,
being an introvert, like you said, there's nothing wrong with it, but it definitely feels like it has a lot of disadvantages in this sphere.
It has, and especially in conventions. If you're not outgoing and extroverted person, like, you're going to get drained a lot less than an introverted person who is going to see like a huge crowd of 3,000 people in a single room and be like absolutely overwhelmed in a second. And yeah, it is hard for some people, and it's understandable. I'm not judging them, but like, that's why I'm advocating. Have a marketing guy. Have someone that would advocate for you. Have someone that would represent you somewhere. You worry about the mechanics and the cool stuff, right?
Yeah, the stuff you like to do. Because I'm sure developers don't like marketing, and marketing people don't like developing.
Absolutely, and it's have the right person for the job. It's extremely crucial in a small team. And as you know, most of the indie teams like wear multiple hats. And this guy's a marketing and video editor and shorts editor, and he makes music as well. He goes to parties, he networks, and
yeah, he does everything. He sleeps 3 hours every night.
Yeah, and having the right person in the studio for a job is very crucial.
I can imagine, because I, as a content creator, I will admit I get a lot of emails, especially with me. The past like few years, I've transitioned to way more indie games because they're genuinely more fun. But the amount of emails that are unprofessional, because there's sometimes when you just know you're not going to click on an email, you can tell. And I hate to say it, but there are some emails that I just won't click on because they didn't title it well. They didn't sell the game well enough. If I have to go out and do my own research on a game, I'm probably not going to end up playing it compared to the ones that sell it to me well. I talked about this in past episodes where if you're marketing the content creators, you got to see what they like and just sell it to them.
Absolutely. And doing the research for content creators was part of my job for a while. And I actually have a funny story about like with emails, because for a month and a half, I was the main contact for content creators. And so I was getting really, like, I was finding content creators, and I have a couple of friends that I've said, hey, can you, like, in your spare time, look at some gaming YouTubers and just send them my way, like, send me links so I can check their channels out while I do it myself as well. Just have a couple of pair of eyes looking at YouTube. From recommended something that watch different videos, might get recommended different channels, so I would get more YouTube channels that way. So I'm sifting through them, and I think I had 120 long list, and I was like, how am I going to message those people? Like, genuinely, how am I gonna do it? And the programmer came and was like, I can write you a tool. I'm like, bet, start working on it. So he wrote me a tool that would, like, I can have some information about the YouTuber and the content creator. And for example, if he's primarily YouTube creator or he's a Twitch streamer, I can have variations of an email composed for him specifically. And I can have random titles, subject lines, I mean. And I can order the email differently in the tool. So I spent like a couple of days just making a very large spreadsheet of reaching out to content creators. And on the second day, that tool broke and it sent, I think, the same email 5 times to a bunch of creators.
Oh, they were probably very annoyed. And then you lose those 5 creators forever, basically.
Yep. Yeah. And I did that. So, but that tool was very good for when it worked. Like, I did message a lot of creators. I think about 30 of the 100 responded.
That's not bad. I was about to ask, what's the percentage? Like 30 out of 100? That's 30%. If you're playing baseball, that's really good.
It is really good, but out of those 30,
yeah,
and ended up making a video or some piece of content, like about 6.
That's still not horrible. If it's
not horrible, but not great.
It's not great. You didn't spend anything, but 30 people responded. 6 were like, okay, I can do this. 24 were like, I'm too busy.
Yep, basically. And we did eventually had, like, we could spare some money, and I decided to sponsor some of the creators that I really like, and I think they're a good fit. So I started working on that. And yeah, but that generally that marketing push that went for about 2 months, generally failed. Like, I consider it a fail, although I did some good things, like in terms of network creating and having a bunch of content creators like on my like short list, so I can message about 5 to 6 creators that like I know at this point. And it is a very hard thing to do, because you have to be the kind of person to chat. You have to be the kind of person to keep a conversation going. You can't be tired. Never.
That's not allowed in this industry.
That's not allowed in this industry. You need to be pushing 24/7, essentially. Having scheduled posts, scheduled everything, content out, record, slice up to Twitch, to YouTube, to TikTok, every platform that you can get your hands on, you should be engaging in it. And the more natural that engagement is, the better, especially with X and TikTok. If it's natural enough, it will get picked up. If it's generic, probably not. The same with content creation, as we've been telling people. Like, you have to be a content creator for this marketing push to work. And you have to be a content creator for the game to work as well, because you're catering to an audience and you're trying to provide something that would be interesting for a lot of players, not just you.
Yes. Now, I had a quick question, because I've seen some controversies in the past on Twitter. When you reached out to content creators about sponsorships, I've seen people, a lot of indie teams, say these giant creators are asking for way too much money, or their agencies are asking for way too much money. Do you feel like a lot of content creators were asking for
an ungodly amount of money
to play a game for a couple hours and advertise it, which I can understand. You have to advertise a game. You're putting your brand on it. But do you feel they'd ask for too much?
Yeah. So I'm not going to name the creator, but I'm going to tell you that for about 5,000 concurrent viewers on Twitch, you get charged about $7,000.
$7,000 for 5,000 viewers? Oh my goodness. I mean, that's just for like an hour?
That's a 2-hour stream.
2-hour stream, and not like, and I imagine like, you know, social posts, all that stuff.
So show post, yeah, included everything that the full package, but it's still for example, a small indie team can generally spare about 10,000 in marketing, and that's seven.
And 7,000 of it's going to one streamer. I thought I was cheap with the deals I give indie devs, because I when I get offered sponsorships from indie teams, I'm just like, they don't have a lot of money, so I'm like, I'm not gonna ask for, you know, a few thousand dollars when I average like 50 viewers. It's like, that's not like, I average a good amount of viewers, you know, 50, 60, but I feel I can also get people to buy the game with the dedicated community, but still 7,000.
That's another thing. Yeah. And funnily enough, like I managed to I managed to haggle the price a lot and I got a heavy discount, but I think we paid for 3,500 for an hour of stream with that content creator, and it gave us absolutely nothing.
It gave you nothing. No wish list.
No, no wish nothing. List. No nothing. No Kickstarter backers. Nothing. Nada. But we had, like, we sponsored another streamer that charges about 200. And from his community, someone backed the Kickstarter for 100. So,
it's just one of those. You never know what's going to happen when you sponsor somebody. I guess it's just like playing roulette or just gambling some money away. You might hit it big. You might not. That's probably the unfortunate side of trying to sponsor a creator.
Yeah, that's why you need a good network. That's why you need a publisher that has the connections.
Yeah,
that would have the dedicated team to research those creators and really know if that creator is going to benefit the game. So that creator, that publisher, like the team of marketing guys know, hey, that creator has a really strong audience and they really like those kinds of games. It would be most likely beneficial to give them money and sponsor that like section of a stream. That would yield us the results. More often than not, they're right, because they've done it so many times. And that's the first time we've been doing it.
That's so crazy. Now, with content creation, I guess I can ask this. With Overrider, has it taken a backseat for now with all the stuff going on with DreamTech Studios while you're trying to figure out what's happening?
Yes, it has taken a seat on the shelf in terms of hardcore development. Like, we're not doing anything with it in terms of development, but we are still talking with people in terms of getting a publishing deal. We are still actively looking for a publisher, possibly. And it's not that we don't want to work on it. We really do. I think there's really something special in it that just needs a bit of polishing to get out, especially with the latest changes that we did for Gamescom and revamping the game loop and like scaling back the ambition of the design approach to something more digestible. That really helped, and a lot of people that played the demo on Gamescom really, really enjoyed. And we actually got the curious feedback that we were really surprised that we still had that problem. A couple of people said, when I looked at the game, if I didn't have the opportunity to play it right away, like on the screen, I wouldn't pick it up.
So you need to make it look more appealing, more eye-catching, maybe?
Maybe change the art style, maybe something like this. I don't know. We just heard that feedback and we're like, oh, curious, because I think the art style looks cool.
Yeah,
maybe that's me.
It kind of looks like, it kind of reminds me of Risk of Rain 2, which is the game that you said kind of inspired it. It gives you that feeling, the 3D, the open world. It's more open world, of course, the fast pace. It's got nice bones. It just needs a little meat. That's one of my sayings. It's not a good saying, but
it is curious to. And that's why the Gamescom, the type of convention, is really good for indie game developers, because it gives you that immediate, like, you place an image of your game here and immediately right on top of it, you get a controller or a keyboard and mouse, and players would they're very much more inclined to try it out on the spot and just have a go at it for 30, 50 seconds. And see where they feel. If they drop it, they drop. If they keep playing, you can ask for feedback. You can try to see where they like it, where they don't like it. Is there certain aspects that are more appealing than others? And have that feedback live. Because with like releasing early access, you don't get that feedback. You don't get that reaction. You don't get that initial feel, because players would say sometimes things that are untrue. And you can see that they're untrue, and you see the expression on the person's face that they don't like what they're seeing, but they say it's good because they don't want to offend you.
Yeah.
But you know that they didn't like it that much, and that's okay, of course.
But as a game developer, if someone doesn't like a game, you want to be offended. You want to know what happened, right?
I mean, at first, yeah, but the more games you do, the more you realize that you're as much incompetent as you were 5 years ago. And it really is a skill that needs to be honed for a longer amount of time to be able to have that feeling of, yeah, I know what I'm doing. Because a game from a game is very different beast. Like a platformer and a racing game are two different things. In terms of design, just strictly design. I'm not talking about development here. I'm talking about design. Design-wise, those two games are so much further from each other than you would think in terms of what design approaches that you need to use for one. They never work on the other. And those design approaches are skills on themselves that you get to develop over time and hone your skills in. So, yeah, you need to be designing a lot of games and a lot of different games. You can't just go 7 Souls-like games and be like, yeah, I can make a racing game.
Oh, you're going to be struggling a lot there. Yeah, you could just keep making exactly. Souls-like games forever, but eventually you're going to get bored. But speaking of making new games, there's one little silly thing you're making out in the world right now, because recently... With the recent stuff with Dream Tech not really focusing on Overrider, you've started streaming a lot more on Twitch, 5 days a week, yeah. Which I think is good. Consistency is king. I guess I first could ask, is it weird or hard to transition from working on games in your own privacy with a team, a more in-depth idea? How different is it compared to just going live on Twitch and potentially having a random guy come in saying, oh, you're doing this wrong?
It is so different, and I find it very difficult to transition. With working with a team, the main thing is you can bounce off ideas really quickly, and you can be very open in your communication. Like in terms of streaming, you're basically alone there. Like game dev streams are not very chatty in terms of engagement in chat.
Unless you're pirate software.
Unless you're Pirate Software, but I would say that Pirate Software doesn't necessarily do a lot of game dev. He does more Q&A, and he does gaming, of course, and he does some game dev, but it's very, like most of the time he's answering questions, and that's where the chattiness come from. But if you drop in another channel that has like 200, 600 viewers, you're going to see chatters, of course, but it's not that many. Like it's 20, 30 people at best, just having a conversation between them. It's not 200 for a 600 viewership. It's a very small percentage. Game dev streams are not very chatty in general, because like you developing a game, especially alone, is very taxing on the mind. It's very... How can I say? Like, I need to reiterate myself points for me to remember them well enough to be able to try to develop something with them. But when I work with a team, like, I'm focused on a lot less tasks in terms of the variety of tasks. So I'm concerned with... For example, this week I'm going to be doing level design for Overrider. And this week I'm going to be just doing that, nothing else. And with developing a game myself on Twitch, like, yes, this month I'm going to be developing Hellfire Arena. Next month I'm going to be developing Hex Survivors. And it's like I have to be able to transition between a lot of different tasks. Today I'm going to do the level generation algorithm. Tomorrow I'm going to do the enemy AI. And those types of things, like, it's so fast that you can't possibly read chat, interact with chat, and then think about the game development side of things. And then think about what you're going to talk about while you're developing the game. Because that's a different skill that I have to develop as well. Talking a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of talking with the Twitch chat. And I guess I could ask, has trying to figure out when to talk with chat, when to speak your mind, I guess, what other challenges have there been with making a new game like the Hyuk Survivors that you're working on? And if you don't know what a Hyuk is, it's the ugly mascot in my Twitch channel.
As the best mascot in a Twitch channel I've seen in a while.
Yeah, it's just ruining your life, it seems like.
Well, I so the way I do things, the way I do game development by myself is I try to be very nonchalant about it, and I try to just push something out without a lot of quality in mind. So specifically for Hyuk Survivors, to reiterate your point that it's kicking my ass, it is one simple thing that's kicking my ass, and that's the programmer side of things, because I am a game designer, I'm not a programmer. I can design structures, I just don't know how to get them to work.
And that's something that you need to somehow learn how to do now.
Exactly, yeah. I need to learn how to do it. I need to learn how to do it well enough for it to work, because you can push something and it would work 10% of the time. And when you get 50 people, that's like at least one person is going to have a working game, another four are not going to have a working game. So like figuring out when to talk to chat and talk to myself is mostly easy, because chat isn't that much active. So I get to speak about the game a lot more and address questions, of course. I get help from chat, of course. I'm not beneath that. But yeah, that skill of talking to myself and having a chat to bounce off ideas. Twitch chat is not very good for bouncing off ideas.
Oh, that's the truth. That is
mainly
the truth.
mainly because of the delay, and the reason that my mind is racing, my thought is running way faster than a chatter can type in their idea. And people are a lot better for that, because you see expressions, you see how they react to stuff. Even in a call, when someone goes, yeah, no, that doesn't make sense, and you can be a lot more quick in your iterations when you have a person beside you in an office or in a studio, or even in a call. That's also very beneficial. And being alone, you get a lot of bubbles. You just keep in a bubble and keep doing your thing. And once it's time to go to do something else, you get in another bubble. That's why it's important to have a team working on a game, because 9 times out of 10, you're better off with a team. Single developers are cool and all. A lot of stuff on that plate. And there's not a lot of people that could handle this. It's a very low number of people that could handle a single person developing a game, especially if you're actually going for something that's playable, unlike me, who just tries to bounce off different ideas and have an idea floating around during the whole stream.
Now, minus the bubbles and the challenges, has it been at least somewhat of a breath of fresh air to try something new like this? Or have you been enjoying the challenge a lot?
I have been enjoying the challenge. I've been happy with streaming. Like, it gets me, it gets my heart pumping when I start to break through with progress, and when I face a certain challenges, because I'm doing this all in visual scripting, which is not coding, but still coding. It's still logically coding, but it's just not characters on a screen. It's just boxes, and you can see a lot of stuff. But I've been enjoying the chill nature of it, where I'm not pressured to make progress, but when I am making progress, I'm feeling good about myself. And that has been really fun, minus some streaming anxiety that's just, I don't know, temporary, I guess.
That happens to a lot of people, that a lot of people get anxious to go live and be on camera and try to, you know, entertain. So that's understandable, but that's good that it's a breath of fresh air. That's what I like to hear. Now,
it is.
you have murdered all of my questions. You have given us great stories and everything, and I love hearing so many different perspectives from so many different developers. But there's always one question I like to end with, and it's, do you have any questions for me? Since I'm the guy that plays the games and, you know, you market to me, do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, what do you want?
I mean, well, that's... well, that's different for every gamer. Me, personally, what do I want in what terms? Like an email, a game?
That is what I was going to pivot to, but can you tell me what, like, email subject lines and what in an email catches your eye to open an email?
Let's see. I'll actually check some of my emails right now, and I'll tell you the first one that catches my eye. Okay, the first one that I have is a game. It says, your blank codes are ready for this game. From insert popular game here. Basically, like, the thing that catches my eye the most as a creator is if you can catch my eye with a game that I already love. Like, let's just go into a crazy word, and you're like, yo, Burr, try our new game, Darkest Dungeon X Enter the Gungeon. I would be like, okay, wait a minute. What the hell are you doing? What are you cooking up? That's the biggest thing that catches me on a subject line. Or sponsorship opportunity, obviously, because who doesn't like money? But minus sponsorship opportunities, it's combining the genres or games that I like and then feeding me something new in your description of it. Like, you get me with the tagline, and then you feed me something with, you know, the game. Like, you link the Steam page, you sell me everything about it, trailers, all of that.
Right. And what's something that puts you off?
Okay, let's see. I'll open up my email again. I'll try to find something. Hopefully they're not listening, but maybe this could be a lesson to them. Wait, this one says it's spam. This is not spam. Show the images, please. Let's see. Well, there's actually a lot of good ones. One thing that's been pushing me off a little bit is, this is going to be weird because you're making a game called Yuck Survivors, but when people throw in the survivor's name, I'm kind of turned away. But I usually also delete a lot of stuff. Like, stuff, if it's a game that it doesn't sound like me, like, it says a review key inside, but it doesn't really say anything else.
All right. So vague.
Vague stuff that doesn't really explain what I'm about to read.
Right.
Or when it just, it, like I said, it just does not sound like something I would play. Like a nowhere, noir mystery puzzle. I'm not going to play a mystery puzzler. Like, you're showing me a game name that I've never heard. But I like it when you... some people may not like it, but just throwing stuff that I like, throwing stuff that the creators like, it gets their attention.
Right, yeah.
Do you have any more questions for the content creator?
Not that I can think of right now.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes. People get surprised with that question. If they have any questions.
No, I didn't. I didn't get surprised with that question.
Oh, you just didn't have anything good. That's fine. I mean, you had a good question with the what catches your eye. That's a good one. But
I think it would be beneficial to... Because marketing is, like, we've talked about it a lot on this podcast, but marketing is hard, and people need to have a person that knows what they're doing. And if that person just listens to a podcast and says, hey, those guys got some really good points. The marketing guy should listen to what they have to say. I'm all for it. Or if someone is just developing solo game and realizes, okay, yeah, I have to do marketing, and I have to do it in a way that makes sense.
100%. Like, there's so many aspects that go into it. If someone is listening and they learn something new, especially from you, that's incredible. You taught somebody, and that's kind
hopefully.
Of. That's everything that I have to say. Sir Danny, do you have anything you want to sell out? What do you want to advertise at the end of this show?
Wishlist Overrider, follow me on Twitch, Danny Makes Games. I will try to be as consistent as possible, and I will try to push games as much as I can because I like games and I like making them.
You heard it here first, folks. All the links will be in descriptions, of course. Thanks for watching this episode of Interview in Indies, and big thanks again to Danny Makes Games, formerly known as Big Danny, for coming on to the show and talking with me for a good hour and a half.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Interview in Indies. If you're an indie game developer and you have an interest in joining this podcast and talking about your project, shoot me an email or DM me on Twitter. And once again, if you want to get this show a few days early and support the show, the best place to do that is Patreon. Thanks for listening again, and we'll see you next time.